About 6 weeks ago, it was April the 11th, a fire started on a 14-acre industrial property in my hometown of Richmond. The business was dedicated to gathering up plastics and sending them abroad for recycling. 4 years ago, the city of Richmond had ordered the owner to repair, demolish, and reduce the volume of stuff on his properties. The owner appealed, and in March 2020, a circuit court judge denied the appeal and said this: the properties, quote, constitute a fire hazard, are a hazard to public health, constitute a nuisance, and are dangerous to people or property because of violations of statute and city ordinance concerning building condition and maintenance. That was in 2020. Well, a fire did start, and the fire chief said that the fire began in a semi-trailer loaded with plastics, then spread to surrounding piles of recyclables, and eventually reaching the building. And the main building was completely full from floor to ceiling, wall to wall. The chief noted that when the firefighters arrived, they had difficulty reaching the buildings because access was blocked by mountains of plastic. The city ordered a half-mile evacuation zone and brought in buses for those who needed assistance in evacuating. The black smoke could be seen as far as Oxford, Ohio. I happened to be driving home from Muncie at that time, and as soon as I turned towards the south, I could see it. As I got closer to home, the smoke was so black and so huge that as I was driving on I-70, the sun was entirely blocked out for a good 5-6 miles. It may have been a neat experience if I hadn't known I was driving under a cloud of toxic smoke, because it was almost like being in a partial eclipse, except it wasn't. It took 2 days to extinguish the fire. According to Richard Peltier, who is a professor of environmental health science, he said this, quote, "We know that it is very common that a large range of chemicals are formed whenever plastic materials are burned, including styrene, benzene, and a wide number of polyaromatic hydrocarbons. All of these are strong carcinogens." And my house happens to be straight to the east of this. All the smoke passed right over our house. And the age of the main building on that property raised concerns about asbestos being released to the atmosphere. Residents relatively close to it reported snow-like debris falling for days. Some was even found as far as Ohio, so we all got warnings. If you see some snowy, fluffy stuff in your yard, don't touch it. Might be wise not to mow your grass for a while. And the stink of burned plastics was everywhere for days. It lasted at least 4 or 5 days at our house. And we're on the other end of town. We're a good, 5-6 miles away from it. And the stink lasted for days that far away. This fire was an instance of environmental racism. How so? Well, let's focus on the environmental part first. Why were recyclables stuffed floor to ceiling indoors and piled in many mountains on a 14-acre property in Richmond, Indiana? Well, as our country has become more and more of a throwaway culture, obsessed with single-use plastics and overpackaging, well, those plastics add up fast. I found a story from Smithsonian Magazine. This was in 2016, already a few years old, but still relevant statistics. In 2016, we on average produced 286 pounds of plastic waste per year, more than any other country. Sam's prelude echoed a lot of the things I'm going to say today. I didn't pay him for that song. That number, the number of pounds of plastic waste each person creates, that number has been growing in our country. It's been growing globally for some time. This same article noted, and keep in mind this story was from 2016, this article noted that from 2014 to 2016, when that article was written, half of the plastics that human beings had ever made were made in those 12 years. Okay, so plastics were invented around World War I. So from World War I to 2004 was half of the world's plastics. 2004 to 2016 was the other half. And I doubt that anything has changed since 2016. If anything, I'm sure it's trending in the bad direction. Well, so how have we as a society dealt with that problem? Well, not only are we the greatest plastics consumer, we're also the planet's greatest plastic polluter. 1 to 2 million metric tons of our plastics are littered, illegally dumped, or mismanaged in their exporting and importing abroad. And that 1 to 2 million metric tons ends up in the environment. And that number, 1 to 2 metric tons, is twice as large as any other country. The number two is India, and they have 3 times our population. Well, the problem kept getting worse, but our solution to it was to outsource our waste to lower income countries. In that environmental slogan, reduce, reuse, recycle, most Americans haven't taken the first two words, reduce and reuse, very seriously, because if we reduce and reuse, we'd have to change our lifestyle. So instead, we've doubled down and tripled down on throwing it away, making more trash, and on recycling, and making our consumption patterns and our waste problems the problem of poor countries. And because we're exploiting cheap labor of places like Vietnam and Bangladesh and Mexico and China, places with weaker environmental laws, more shortcuts can be made, and there still ends up being a profit of taking our trash, sending it abroad, and then recycling it into raw materials. Here's the problem. Most of those countries in recent years have said, we don't want your trash anymore. The small profit that they get on their end is no longer being seen as worth it when compared to the cost to their own environments and people. So this is the environmental part of how the fire in Richmond was an instance of environmental racism. The plastics kept piling up because nobody was going to take them. Well, what about the racism part? Waste and pollution follow the paths of least resistance. And that statement is true in our state, in our country, and on our planet. Neighborhoods, communities, and even nations that are majority people of color tend to have less input and political clout about what ends up where. Sam even included in his song, the acronym is NIMBY, not in my backyard. So when a business is looking for a spot to put their landfill or their medical waste incinerator or their factory farm or their chemical plant or their uranium mine and so on, sometimes they face resistance from people who don't want it in their backyard. Put that thing somewhere else, not here. Well, where do you think that somewhere else ends up being? Well, it ends up being places with the cheapest land. Have you been to Richmond? It's a Rust Belt town, that's for sure. So it ends up being places with cheap land, in places where the people have less political power than others. So when it gets pushed from your backyard, it gets pushed to the backyard of people who can't stop it. Or it ends up in those places where people are so desperate for the income that they say yes, even knowing what the cost is going to be. Those mountains of plastics that had piled up in Richmond were in one of the poorest parts of town. It's also the part of town with the most signs in Spanish. Well, some of you might be thinking, well, so maybe this is actually then a class matter and not a racial matter. Well, the answer is kind of yes, but mostly no. Class and wealth is definitely playing a huge role in what we're talking about. So in that sense, yes, it's a class matter. But no, because the class matters are thoroughly intertwined with race. Let me drop you some stats. These stats come from the EPA and a variety of nonprofit organizations. Stat number one, black Americans are exposed to 56% more pollution than they produce. Latin Americans are exposed to 63% more pollution than they produce. White folks are exposed to 17% less pollution than they produce. So if you're black or Hispanic, you're exposed to 56% and 63% more pollution than you make. But if you're white, you're exposed to 17% less pollution than you make. People of color have higher rates of illnesses like cancer and asthma as a result of that pollution. And we saw the tragedy of this unfold during COVID. Stat number two, most of our country's Superfund sites. So Superfund site are those places that the federal government has deemed the most contaminated. Most Superfund sites are within 1 mile of federal funded housing projects. Stat number three, 68% of black folks live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant. Stat four, African-American children are 5 times more likely to have been exposed to lead poisoning than white children. Stat five, renal disease is more than 3 times the national average in the Navajo Nation. Why? It's a result of water and soil pollution from uranium mining. Why did the federal government mine uranium there? Well, partly it's because it's there, but partly it's also because we could cut environmental corners because it was on a Navajo Nation, it was on an indigenous nation. We didn't have to follow the same environmental laws as we did outside the res. Here is the statistical exclamation point on why this is actually race far more than class. The United Church of Christ funded and published a study titled Toxic Waste and Race at 20. They were studying 1987 to 2007. And the study had 4 academic authors. What they found was that race was far more significant than socioeconomic status in predicting the location of the nation's commercial hazardous waste facilities. So if we map race and we map pollution, they match. What they found was that even black Americans making $50,000 to $60,000 a year were more likely to live in polluted areas than white counterparts making $10,000. So if we say it's class, well, clearly it's not. Because if you're comfortably middle class but you're black, you're still exposed to more pollution than the poorest of white people. Well, so what can we do? Well, there's plenty we can do for the environmental part. The more that we reduce and reuse, the less need there is for trash and recycling, and the less need there is to find a place for it to go. I forgot to grab my prop, 1 second. Now, I take plenty of plastic packaging out of the grocery store, as we all do, but I haven't used a produce bag in over a decade because I bought a set of these mesh bags that come in 3 different sizes. So all my produce goes in these reusable bags. And I got a half a dozen of these nice, they collapse down, for my groceries. Now, you have to make sure you don't put all your canned goods in one of these mumbo jumbos. But my point being, I don't use any plastic in my produce or my groceries. Small everyday choices like these do add up. At the end of the service, we'll probably move this down to the fellowship hall. I've got a set of pens and some little scraps of paper. I want everyone to write down your own tips on how we can reduce our plastics usage, and we'll eventually post them onto a bulletin board. Now, admittedly, grand systemic changes are going to take more than just being mindful of our reducing and our reusing. Reverend William Barber, if you don't know that name, he is the creator and leader of the Poor People's Campaign. He says that the answers to environmental racism are to be found in fusion politics. He says fusion politics refers to uniting together of people across all categories to push for change and the creation of a new way of thinking about ourselves, about one another, and about our planet. Here's a quote from him. "We cannot separate the question of whether we can survive together on a warming planet from the question of whether we can redeem the promise of liberty and justice for all in this nation." So he says, dealing with the climate crisis means we have to reclaim democracy, and reclaiming democracy means dealing with the climate crisis. Not a small job, of course. A whole lot of work remains. But Barber says that he chooses to believe that the America that has never been may nevertheless still be. Where does his optimism and hope come from? Well, Barber says that if plutocrats, and that's the word he uses for people in power who are invested in things as they are, he says that those plutocrats would not be trying so hard to keep the system as it is if they did not fear that it could be undone. So their resistance to change means that change is possible. Because if change was impossible, they wouldn't need to resist it. Well, what would fusion politics look like when we applied it to the topic of environmental racism? The website of Elizabeth Warren is an excellent resource in answering that question. She says that combating environmental racism requires, one, improving wealth in frontline communities, the people who bear the brunt of pollution and climate change, to expand healthcare, to apply political pressure for sound environmental policies, including funding clean air and water and green energy. She says we need to hold polluters accountable, and we need to mitigate disasters and improve disaster responses. Now, those things aren't small things, but they are perfectly achievable if enough people want them to happen. And gains in one area will bring gains in another. So that's fusion politics, when we lift up people and the state of our planet at the same time. Well, making deep and long-lasting systemic changes to how we think and essentially how we do everything, that's about as aspirational as it gets. But fusion politics, I think of it like beloved community. It's a vision. It's an aspiration we can strive for. When we're looking at big problems like the environment or racism, or especially when they're together, it can be overwhelming to think about. But remember, we don't have to go from here to beloved community next week. We know that that's not possible. It doesn't have to be done in one grand leap. And we know that there will be stops and detours along the way, and perhaps even sometimes pushes backwards. But nonetheless, many of us doing small things does steadily move everything forward. When we reduce our use of plastics, clearly that's a boon for the environment, but it's also a boon for people. Because less plastics means less oil. And it means less waste and pollution, fewer fires, less illegal dumping. Right? And all of those things, the waste and pollution, the illegal dumping and so on, all of them will follow the path of least resistance toward people of color and their neighborhoods and nations. So when we redress those things, We're improving the lives and health of human beings who are living in those places. Our choices matter. And our choices can have compounding impacts. So I invite all of us today to consider, how do our personal choices and how are plastics political? In fact, they are political. because they're about people and the environment simultaneously. So what can we do to contribute to fusion politics? Number one, for the sake of our planet, and number two, for the sake of all. So may it be.